Chapter 2. For a long time, the thing I was most afraid of was being left out. Alone on an island in the Caribbean, left behind as the other guard banded together without me. That wasn't exactly helpful when I was also afraid of getting too close to anyone for fear of them finding out my secret, that I'm not human. I had a really crappy life because of all this. Until I met Ethan. Until the Moogs took me in. Now I have no worries of ever being left out, and I'll definitely never feel alone. It would be impossible to. There must be thousands of us living together on the West Virginia base. The compound the Moogs have here is maybe the most incredible structure on Earth, even if few humans will ever see the inside of it. It's hidden in a hollowed-out mountain, and is so vast and full of trailing tunnels and caves that I doubt anyone has seen every corner of the place. I've spent a lot of my free time floating around the corridors and rocky hallways, and I think I've seen only a 20th of it. It's almost all Moogs here, the Vatborn soldiers and servants and the Trueborn higher-ups. But there are a handful of humans. Most aren't here by choice, though Ethan's an exception, as are the men and women in dark suits and military garb whom I pass in the halls on occasion. And there's one other Lorik. 9. I follow Ethan through the cavernous main hall, floating a few feet above him because flying is good practice, and Ethan says it reminds the others that I'm powerful. I don't mind, really, because it's easier than walking. There are dozens, maybe even hundreds, of Moogs who we pass as we head towards the detention cells. They stop walking and step aside as I go by, staring at me. Some of them nod in respect, knowing that one day I'll be a powerful force in the Moog ranks. Others look at me with skepticism. I can feel their eyes on me as I fly over them. The only really annoying thing about the base is the scalding hot green stuff that flows throughout it and pools in the main chamber. It's some sort of energy source for the Moogs, Ethan said. But if you touch it, it'll eat through your skin like acid. Or at least, that's what I hear. I haven't been dumb enough to actually test that theory out. Whatever it is, it smells like sulfur and rotten coconuts. As we pass through the main hall, the scent is heavy in my nose, and I grimace. Why do you think we've been summoned? I ask Ethan. He shrugs. Maybe Commander Deltok thinks it's time for you to take your place in the leadership. As a commander, Deltok is the highest-ranking Moog in charge of the base. He reports to a General Sutek, and sometimes our beloved leader directly. He's also become my de facto keeper, the person Ethan reports to, and who I assume is on the other side of the one-way glass watching me in my study half the time. He's an aggressive, true-born Moog. I've come to learn that's something to be proud of around here, and takes exquisite delight in telling me that I don't look anything like a soldier. He has never explicitly said that I may be a little on the heavy side, but it's almost certainly what he's thinking. I'm always a little on edge around Deltok. I can't help but want to impress him every time I see him. For my part, the detention area is the one place I'm not allowed to go on the base. I've seen only the first few cells. Ethan says it's because they don't want me to hurt 9 just yet. They're still trying to figure out a way to force him to spill everything he knows about the guard. And besides, since his death will be so important, it must be ceremonious. I've wondered what it would be like to be imprisoned here, like 9. To spend all day in a cold stone cell. It sounds terrible. But then, I don't have to worry about it. I chose to join the Moogs, to serve their cause in order to elevate myself. I'm sure the others here had the same chance. They just threw it all away. And for what? Do the imprisoned humans really think their own resistance to the Moogs means a damned thing in the long run? That they're anything other than a speck of dust in what will be the vast empire of the Mogadorians? Maybe I would have thought that once, but not after seeing their resources and strength with my own eyes. We pass row after row of containment cells in the detention wing, the entrances barred and pulsing with some kind of blue energy field. I keep my eyes darting back and forth, trying to catch a glimpse of Nine, to no avail. Inside are the weak and unrepentant enemies of the Moogs. Most of them are humans who got a little too close to figuring out what was happening around them on Earth and refused to quit snooping, or who disobeyed orders. The traitors are being taught an important lesson about crossing their superiors, one they won't forget when they go back out into the world after they've served their time, which is what Ethan says happens to most of the ones who realize the error of their ways. A few are test subjects or people somehow related to the Lorik cause. I hear there are even a few greeters in captivity, those whose job it was to introduce the Lorik to the human ways of life on Earth. Not all of them were as smart as Ethan was. It's hard to imagine that he might have been in one of these cells had he not foreseen the Moog's inevitable victory. Deltok stands in the middle of the hallway. He's at least 2 heads taller than me and built like a giant wrestler shoved into an ominous black officer's uniform. His skin is pale, and his hair is gleaming jet black and pulled into a tight ponytail. Dark tattoos peek out around his hairline, above eyes like big black marbles.
"So thrilled you could join us," he says flatly as I approach.
He glances at Ethan and sneers slightly. Despite Ethan's role as my recruiter and mentor, I don't think Deltok has been a big fan of having a human roaming around his base with so much authority. "Whatever our beloved leader requires of me," I say.
"Our afternoons are usually spent expanding upon Phi's powers for the good of Mogador," Ethan says,
which I recognize as his way of asking why we've been ordered to come to this side of the compound. Deltok narrows his eyes a little.
"I assume you must have been in the middle of something very important, since it took you so much time to get here."
I start to stammer a response, but Ethan speaks on my behalf.
"He was just reading from the Great Book," he says, grinning. "What could be more important than our beloved leader's words?"
Deltok smirks in a way that bears all of his gray, shark-like teeth. It's not exactly a happy expression.
"You're here because the all-wise Satrakis Ra is anxious for Five to prove himself loyal to the Mogadorians. We're looking forward to him taking his rightful place as a high-ranking member of the leader's forces as well," Ethan says. "But these things take time, as I'm sure—"
"Five,"
Deltok says, ignoring Ethan. He steps aside and points a long, thick finger at one of the cells.
"Do you wish to see the power of the guard?"
Ethan starts to protest, but I nod. "Yes, sir." I step up to the blue force field and stare. There's a prisoner inside, stretched out on a dirty slab of rock serving as a bed. The guy is shirtless, his muscles glinting under a sheen of sweat. Long, dark hair is spread out around his head. His eyes are closed, and his lips move slightly, as if he's meditating or saying some sort of prayer. "Number 9.
"He doesn't speak when he's conscious, but he talks in his sleep sometimes,"
Deltok says.
"That's how we figured out his number."
Something within me stirs as I look at Nine. Not pity or brotherhood, but something unsettling, a sort of fear. When the Moogs first recruited me, they gave me a folder with Nine's picture inside it. He's to be my victim, the blood offering that proves my loyalties to the Mogadorian progress. The only thing is, I've never killed anyone before. I had a hard time even killing animals back on the island with Ray. And so deep down I'm afraid that when the time comes and I'm finally given the order to end Nine's life, I won't be able to do it. Thankfully, whatever magic the Elders of Lorien worked on us when we were kids is still in effect, because there's no way I can kill Nine out of order. At least, not that the Moogs or I know of. If there's a way to dispel the magic that protects us, that knowledge probably died with Ray or the Elders. I have no idea how to break the charm.
"What do you think?"
Deltok asks.
"Is the hunger for power rising up inside you? Are you ready to take the next step and ascend into power among us?"
My stomach drops. They have brought me here to kill Nine. I swallow hard and try to steel my churning guts. Deltok lets out a little laugh.
You look pale all of a sudden, Five,
he says, his voice a low bellow. I don't answer. I can't take my eyes off Nine. Another guard. It's the first time I've seen him in person instead of in the photograph pinned up in my study. He's thinner now than he is in the picture. A side effect of whatever they have or haven't been feeding him, I assume. But he's still built like a Greek statue. Strong-looking. Deltok has obviously noticed this, because he's quick to mention it.
He's managed to stay in incredibly formidable shape, despite being a prisoner,
he says, very pointedly, not looking at my less-than-athletic build.
I'm told he spends most of his waking moments exercising in his cell.
I change the subject. Why doesn't he use his powers to escape? I ask.
He's tried. Many times.
Deltok motions to the pulsing blue shield.
But we've learned to keep him under control.
Maybe he's just waiting for the perfect time to lash out, I say. Deltok bares his teeth.
Come with me,
he says, turning and heading deeper into the detention wing. Eventually we come to some kind of cell that looks like it's part interrogation room and part laboratory. There are chains hanging from the ceilings and silver gurneys on one side and a few tables on the other. The room smells of bleach. What is this place? I murmur.
This is where many of our prisoners' fates are decided,
Deltok says.
Where they choose to give themselves over to the Mogadorians and offer us their intelligence, or they condemn themselves to a cell indefinitely.
I glance at Ethan, but his eyes are fixed on Deltok. Usually Ethan knows everything that's going on at the base, or at least he does when it involves me. But he seems to be as confused as I am as to why we're here.
Many brave soldiers gave their lives in this room when Nine first arrived, as they tested the strength of the Loric magic that protects him,
Deltok says, running his finger over a tray of shiny scalpels.
That's how they proved themselves loyal to the Mogadorian Empire.
And you are okay with wasting soldiers like that? I ask.
We do not consider it a waste.
The commander has an angry edge to his voice now.
It is the highest honor to die for the Mogadorian cause. Besides, the Loric charm is not something we wholly understand. We weren't sure if it was possible to weaken the charm so much that it broke completely. It was a possibility we could not ignore.
But you couldn't get rid of it. It's more a statement than a question that comes out of my mouth.
No,
Deltok frowns.
No matter how hard we tried. And Nine didn't say a word. He just laughed as some of our finest men died in front of him.
His expression changes and becomes almost pleasant.
But his Sepan did talk.
What? Ethan asks. Apparently this is news to him as well.
This is confidential information,
Deltok says, shrugging towards Ethan. What about his Sepan? I ask. Do you have him too?
We did, Deltok says. But Number Nine murdered him.
My mouth drops open. He what?
His Sepan was smart. We were still trying to negotiate and give Nine and his guardian a chance to join our cause. The Sepan was going to talk, to cut a deal with us. And when Nine found out, he murdered the Loric in cold blood.
Deltok takes a few files off one of the lab tables and hands them to me.
See for yourself,
he says. I open the top folder and am greeted by a stack of photos, stills from a security camera in the very room I'm standing in. Only in the photos, there are two figures. One looks like an older human. He's hanging upside down from the ceiling, with thick chains wrapped around his ankles. There's blood everywhere. Nine stands beside the man, a dagger in his hands.
It's my own fault, really,
Teltok says.
I left the two of them in this room together and assumed that Nine had a sense of loyalty. Obviously, I was wrong. The guard used his powers to break through his containment field and attacked the brave Moogs guarding him. It took a few minutes before we were able to get into the room, but that's all he needed.
I flip through the photos. They're like a slideshow, and I watch as Nine steps closer and closer to his sepan, raising his weapon. And then finally, he buries the blade in his guardian's chest. In the next few pictures, Moogs show up and drag him away, but the damage has already been done. Nine struggles against their grip, gnashing his teeth, and then he's gone. The last photo is just the sepan, hanging upside down, alone, lifeless. My memory jumps back to Ray, dying in our little hut on the beach. Sure, we didn't get along a lot of the time, and he was probably a little crazy, but I can't imagine I could ever have killed him. He was the person who raised me. I'd always been taught to think that the guard were these saint-like people, that we had to be perfect in order for our planet to have a chance at being resurrected, that the Lorik were a peaceful, inherently good race, while the Moogs were evil incarnate. It dawns on me that this was just more Lorik propaganda, that the Lorik and Moogs probably don't have that many differences between them, other than the fact that the Moogs don't pretend to be anything that they aren't. Ethan always says that history is subjective, and that the history I knew to be true was just the Lorik side of things. Besides, now that I've felt the power that comes with my legacies, and how good it feels to have people see the potential in me, I can't imagine that Lorien was the utopia Ray made it out to be. "Have you brought me here to kill him?" I ask.
"Not yet," Deltok says. "Not until we figure out a way to break this charm. There's no way of knowing what would happen if one of the other guard tried to inflict death upon him. And we don't want to lose our secret weapon. You. Your most valuable asset," Ethan says to the Moog. "Exactly," Deltok says.
He motions to the photographs.
"But when the time comes, be careful. He's unhinged. He's hardly even an intelligent life form anymore, just an animal. I imagine he wouldn't think twice about killing you if given the opportunity."
I turn back to the photographs. An animal. Staring at the crazed look in Nine's eyes as he howls, his sepan's blood on his hands. I believe it. All I can think is what an idiot he is to willingly choose murder and imprisonment instead of the opportunity I've been given. How stupid Nine must be, and how one day this chained-up animal will be my ticket to the top of the food chain. Chapter 3. After seeing Nine in action, at least in photos, Deltok insists that I take the rest of the files the Moogs have on him, so that I can study them well. "Know your enemy," he says, and then he cancels my afternoon training with Ethan while I retreat to my room on the other side of the compound. The place they've made for me here in Moog Central isn't as nice as, say, Ethan's beach house in Miami, but it's pretty plush. I wouldn't even know I was half a mile inside a mountain if it wasn't for the fact that all the walls are made of smoothed-down stone. I've got a big king-size bed, a giant TV, and an arsenal of gaming consoles and games I've never even heard of before. Mogadorian battle simulators that have graphics any next-gen console would kill for. The Moogs had them arranged for me because Ethan told them how much time I'd spent playing games in my downtime back in Florida. These are unlike anything I've ever played, though. A weird combination of military and governing missions. It took me a while to get the hang of them, because I was so used to playing games where you got points deducted every time you caused collateral damage or civilian casualties. But I'm getting a lot better. With Nine's files in hand, though, I ignore all the electronics and stuff that the Moogs gave me and go straight to my bed. There, I spread out the papers and reports on Nine. Ethan had told me that Nine lived in luxury in Chicago. But it turns out that's pretty general speculation based on what they pieced together from Nine and some former girlfriend of his who was working with the Moogs for a while. They don't actually know where his place is in the city. One of the things included in the files is a transcription from an interview with Nine Sepan that the Moogs have typed up for me. He says that Nine lived a charmed life. He never wanted for anything and went and did whatever he pleased. On one hand, I'm not surprised that he ended up in a Moog cell, but on the other, my jealousy of how he got to grow up compared to how I lived burns somewhere deep in my chest. They even have quotes from his Sepan about how Nine was a popular kid in school who had girls following after him wherever he went and lived like a miniature king on campus. Meanwhile, I was eating coconut meat for lunch and sweating half to death in the Caribbean. At the end of the interview is a brief section where the Sepan discusses how the elders decided on our numbers. It wasn't random. They were given that order for a reason. The elders judged who they thought were the strongest and brightest, those with the most potential, and saved them for the end. The first few were hardly anything more than cannon fodder. Their Sepans were instructed to keep them hidden no matter the cost to their well-being, so that the higher numbers would be kept safe. After all, the guard didn't very well die if their order wasn't up. I always considered myself lucky to have been assigned to the highest number. Nine rarely thought of anyone lower than him unless it was from a tactical standpoint. It was always assumed that if the guard ever did come together to fight, Nine would be the one who would command them. I have to stop reading. My head pounds, and with one brisk surge, I send the files flying across my room in a telekinetic wave. I throw open my Lorik chest that sits on the nightstand beside me. My favorite thing inside it, the only thing I've really learned to use, is a concealed blade inside a gauntlet. I use my powers to send it sailing through the air, popping out the knife hidden inside. It skewers the sheet of paper with the Sepan's interview on it and embeds itself in the stone wall of the room. I start to rummage through my chest, which usually helps me focus and calm down. But it's no good. I'm too wound up. Then I throw myself down onto the bed and crack my knuckles as anger boils up inside me. So that's what Nine thought of us? Of me? That I was worthless? That I'd be someone he could command one day? Well, the joke's on you, Nine, because now you're the one hidden away, and I'm the person with all the power. I'm the one who's going to control everyone else. Over the course of the next few weeks, I continue my daily routine of studying, training, and learning more about Mogadorian culture. Every time I see the picture of Nine in my study, I get frustrated and pissed off as I think about the files of him and his Sepan, regarding the lower numbers as being weak. I try to channel this into my training, like when Ethan takes me into an unused room in order for us to do a little training on my legacies. Ethan sets a box down on the metal table in the middle of the room, while I use my telekinesis to straighten all the chairs and get them all pushed in and out of the way.
Your ability to move things with your mind has really progressed both in terms of strength and finesse, Ethan says. The Moog leaders and I are all very impressed.
Thanks, I say with a grin. I have gotten pretty good at moving boulders around in the tunnels.
True, he nods. So today I want us to focus on your externa. In particular, the quickness with which you can change forms and the length of time you can stay in them.
This sounds easy enough. I've gotten good at taking on the properties of the things I touch. I reach into my pocket, where my fingers find the red rubber ball. My skin stretches, and my fingers take an elongated form, like the kind of fingers people who have never actually seen an alien would expect me to have.
Let's do it.
Ethan starts to toss things at me left and right from the box he brought with him, hardly giving me time to change before my body has to reset and transform again. I hold a leather-bound book and my skin grows tough. I catch a smooth white stone, and I'm a moving statue.
Excellent,
Ethan says.
But can you do it while flying?
Without answering, I float up in the air and continue to change as Ethan tosses more and more objects at me. We keep it up for a few minutes, and then suddenly I start to get tired. I've never overworked my legacies like this before, but I don't show any weakness. I think about 9 Sepan and how he thought the higher numbers were better than me. And I power through the fatigue, gritting my teeth and imagining myself standing over 9 as he begs for mercy. Ethan tosses me something small and shiny that I catch with my telekinesis and float over to my hand.
Do the stone, not the band,
he says as it travels through the air. I don't understand until I realize that I've got a diamond ring in my palm. No problem, I say, touching the gem with the tip of my pinky. My skin hardens and takes on a brilliant shine. The tips of my fingers are completely clear. I float over to the steel table and drag one of my fingernails along the top of it, engraving the numeral 5 into it. Now this could come in handy, I say.
Sure, Ethan says. If you want to be the target of every weapon on the battlefield. Your skin is too shiny. It would be impossible to be incognito. But keep this form for now. Let's see how long you can hold it.
I wave my arms around in front of me and watch the light bounce off them, sending reflections all around the room. I think I met some people down in Miami who would have me chopped up into pieces and sold off for millions if they could see me now. The harder I concentrate while I touch the stone, the clearer my body gets and the harder my skin becomes. But it takes work, and the more I focus, the more my head starts to pound, and I start to feel like I'm losing control of my body. When I first developed the Externa ability, I was terrified that I'd never be able to revert back to my normal form again. Suddenly, that same fear attacks me, and my heart rate and breathing go through the roof. I must look like I'm afraid, because when Ethan says,
5, calm down, buddy,
his voice is steady and slow. He sounds like that only when he's concerned. So I take a few deep breaths, close my eyes, and let the ring fall to the ground as my feet find the stone floor again. I tune out the world for a few seconds and just concentrate on my normal body and how much I want to be back in it. When I open my eyes again, my fingers are pink and soft. I'm back, but my head is still pounding.
Ow, I say, raising a hand to my right temple.
Headache?
Yeah.
We'll get you some aspirin, Ethan says. But hey, that was great. This is where we'll start focusing our training from now on.
I think of 9. And how Deltok doesn't think I look like much of a soldier. I'm fine, I insist. I can keep going.
I don't want you to hurt yourself.
Ethan must think I'm weak, too.
I'm not some kid, Ethan, I say. I'm a superpowered Lorik, and the guy who's going to be the Moog officer in charge of this country. If I say I can keep going, I can.
Ethan looks a little taken aback. Before he gets a chance to say anything, the door bursts open, and Commander Deltok enters. A flash of annoyance crosses Ethan's face as he turns to his superior.
Commander, he says with a little nod of a bow. To what do we owe the pleasure? You're needed, Ethan,
the Moog says.
Report to Central Command.
Ethan waves at me.
Come along, 5. You should go back to your room and get some rest. The Lorik stays. I have a surprise for him.
There's a moment when Ethan and Deltok just stare in defiance at one another. Deltok must win in the end, because Ethan shrugs, gives me a fleeting glance, and then turns on his heel. Just like that, he's gone, and I'm left alone with the Moog commander. I don't realize how accustomed I am to Ethan always being there until he's gone. I wonder if today is the day. If they're taking me to try to kill 9.
5, Deltok says through his sharp, dark teeth. How is your training going?
It's good,
I say, nodding fervently, which only makes my head hurt more. But I ignore that. I can show you if you want. I blink, and in the course of doing so, the chairs all fly out from under the table, spin around the room, and then go right back to where they began. Whatever Deltok has in store for me, I know I need to impress him, to show him that I'm doing well, and that I'm ready to take the next step. Deltok chuckles a little, but it doesn't sound like he's actually amused.
A good trick, he says. I'm sure our enemies will cower in fear when they see our great army of chairs and tables laying siege to their cities.
I can move something else, I say, feeling stupid. Something bigger, or a bunch of swords or something.
What I have in mind for you today is a little more interesting. A true treat. Come, follow me.
We move in silence through the compound. I fly. He walks. We head towards the front entrance that leads out into a wooded area that's fenced off from the rest of the world. I'm not forbidden to go outside by any means, but for caution's sake I have to get approvals and a tracker and all kinds of boxes checked off if I want to spend the day in nature, so I hardly ever do. Besides, I'm much more of a beach person, and it's cold up here in West Virginia. I've grown used to much warmer climates. The entrance to the compound is camouflaged and well guarded. Soldiers salute as we pass by. And then we're just hiking through the woods, and I'm completely lost as to what we're doing. I can't even fly here with all the low-hanging branches. I'd have to be above the tree line. And soon, I get a little short-winded as we hike along, which I try to mask by breathing as quietly as possible. "Where are we going?" I ask, clouds of white escaping my lips in the cold.
I told you. It's a surprise.
I try to figure out why Deltok would go through the trouble of arranging something for me. Is this some sort of ploy to get me to exercise more? Or is he leading me out into the woods to teach me some new kind of Mogadorian fighting that requires the open air? Is he leading me to Nine? I slip a hand into my pocket and let my fingers close around the metal ball, just in case. But I discover that it's none of these things as soon as we come to a clearing. Standing in the winter sunlight is the last person I'd ever expect to see here. Emma. Chapter 4. It takes me a second to realize that Emma is actually there and not some sort of hologram or android or something. But it really is her. I can tell because holograms don't leave footprints in the dirt as they shift their weight back and forth nervously on their feet. And androids don't cry. Emma looks terrified. I can't really blame her. She probably should be scared. She's grown up a bit in the year or so since I last saw her, when she was swinging a metal pipe at my head the night of the botched job, the night Ethan took me in. When we were running the beaches as small-time crooks, her black hair was always pulled back into a short ponytail. But it's around her shoulders now, hanging messily halfway down her back. She's wearing pink pajama bottoms and a white tank top, which leads me to assume that she was taken in the middle of the night. Someone thought to give her a trench coat like all the Moogs wear, which practically swallows her. She must not have been expecting to see me, because when I step out of the trees and into view, she freezes, her face twisting in shock.
Cody?
She stammers through shivering lips. I'm not sure if she's shaking because of the cold or something else. It's been a long time since I went by that name, and it takes a second for my memory to catch up with what she's saying and to realize that she means me. Hi, Emma, I murmur. I don't know what to say or do or even how to feel. Why has this girl been plucked out of Florida and brought up to West Virginia? My first instinct is to go to her. But there's a look in her eyes that stops me. I recognize it as a mixture of confusion and hatred. The same look she had in Miami when she called me a freak, right before she tried to bash my brains in. I turn to Deltok, who is emerging from the trees now. When Emma sees him, she cowers a little and takes a few steps back. Obviously, she's had a bad experience with Moogs over the last day or so.
Good. We did find the right girl, he says. You'd be surprised how difficult she was to track down. After that unfortunate night at the warehouse, she and most of her family practically disappeared.
What's going on? I ask.
Before you are able to begin your new life as a champion of the Mogadorian cause, you'll have to put everything from your past behind you.
I don't say anything. Just turn to Emma and stare at her. She still looks scared, but her hands are clenched in fists at her sides. I know her well enough to guess that right now she's trying to figure out how to escape from this situation. She's a fighter. Hell, the last time I saw her, she gave me a concussion. How do you even know about her? I ask.
Ethan's reports on you have been incredibly thorough. Even now, Deltok says.
I must look surprised by this, because he lets out a snort of a laugh.
The two of you may have a close relationship, but the reason that Ethan found you in the first place is thanks to our beloved leader's guidance and enthusiasm to recruit you. You would be incorrect if you thought for one moment that your future was given to you by Ethan and not the all-powerful Satrakus Ra. Ethan is your friend because he was ordered to be.
I know Ethan works for the Moogs, but I guess I never really think of him as reporting back to them about me. At least, not about non-essential stuff like who I hung out with back in Miami. But I've read the files the Moogs have on Nine, so I guess I shouldn't be surprised. Still, it somehow seems like a betrayal of trust, and I wish Ethan were here to tell me that it wasn't true. I know he lied to me back when we first met, but that was for my benefit. I guess I'd assumed he wouldn't still be reporting on me now that I'm at the base. The thought pisses me off.
At the end of the day, Deltok continues, Ethan is only human. That's his great weakness. The humans don't have our discipline or sense of loyalty. It will do you well to remember that. The humans are here to serve us. But he is holding you back.
How?
He doesn't think you're ready to become an officer.
My mouth drops open a little. Ethan doesn't believe in me? That can't be true. Why is she here? I ask, turning back to Emma. I still don't understand what's going on. Please, Emma says. I just want to go back home. I don't want to be here. I'll give you whatever you want.
For you to have closure and to focus completely on your future as an officer of Mogador,
Deltok says with a grin.
Ethan said this girl was the only other person in the world who you had any sort of friendly relationship with.
I guess so, I say quietly. When he puts it like that, it makes me sound like a total loser.
Well then, what happened?
The memories course through my head. A bunch of thugs trapped me in a warehouse on a job for Ethan. The only way out had been using my telekinesis. I'd never used it on other people before, and it felt so good to slam them into shelves and walls after they'd been beating up on me. But Emma had seen. One of the guys had been her brother, and she'd turned on me in an instant. She called me a freak, I say, staring at Emma in the forest clearing. She asked me if I was possessed when she saw what I could do. Please, Emma says. She just keeps shaking her head, her eyes darting around to the edges of the tree line. She was standing there alone when we came out, but I'm guessing there are Moog soldiers in the woods around us, making sure she doesn't escape.
She scoffed at your abilities?
Deltok asks.
Even though you'd been friends?
We'd been more than friends, I say, taking a step towards her. We were partners.
The humans will fear you when you are unveiled as their leader. You can use that fear and turn it into respect. Some will cower and hide or try to fight you, but the smart ones will bow at your feet. You can't hesitate when it comes to taking action. You have to know when to show mercy and when to be ruthless.
Ruthless? My palms start to sweat as I begin to imagine what Deltok has brought me out here to do. Why did you bring her here? I ask again.
She was frightened by just a taste of your abilities. She fought you, disrespected you. Why don't you show her what true power is?
I stare at Emma. She's shaking, her eyes now fixed on me as her fingers tremble. The Emma I remember from the beach, before things went bad between us, was cool, confident, and my partner in crime. I'd wanted her to think I was like her. But now I see her for what she really is. Just a scared girl who has no idea what's happening in the world around her. A pitiful, naive aunt. Human. Part of me has always been angry about the shitty things she said and did to me at the warehouse. But I don't know that she deserves to be hurt because of that. I don't know that I can hurt her, as pathetic as she looks. She's not worth it, I say as I turn back to Deltok and start towards him. Please! Emma screams. She must be afraid of what will happen once the only familiar face here disappears.
Just let me go home. I don't want anything to do with you monsters!
Monsters? Something in me snaps. I whip around to her, holding my right arm outstretched. She lets out a short gasp as she rises off the ground. My telekinesis is wrapped around her body, squeezing her tightly. As I raise my hand, she goes farther up. I rise too until I'm floating just a few yards in front of her. We have to be 30 feet in the air. Her eyes are wide as they stare into mine. She keeps making little gasping noises, even though I'm not squeezing her all that hard. I can barely hear her ragged breaths over the repetition of the word monsters in my head. If you want to call me a monster, I can be a monster, I say.
No,
she shakes her head. I could crush you with a single thought, I whisper, and the look of horror on her face makes my blood race and my ears pound. That part of me that has festered with anger and wants revenge for the way she turned her back on me feels so satisfied that I can hardly breathe. It's not just her. It's all the times I've felt weak or lost or like the Lorik had forgotten about me or forsaken me. All of it courses through me, fueling me. I know 9 is supposed to be my symbolic first kill. But maybe Deltok has taken me out here to see if I really have what it takes. Maybe I should squeeze her a little tighter with my legacy. Or let her drop back to the hard ground below us. But then another voice joins our little party and interrupts my thoughts.
5, Ethan says. Put her down.
He turns to Deltok and speaks in an angry whisper that's loud enough for me to hear.
No one told me about this. What the hell is going on out here?
I'm observing the future of the Mogadorian cause,
Deltok replies.
5, come back to the ground.
You are not in charge here.
Deltok's voice is calm but booming. I can see his nostrils flare a little bit.
Do not stand in the way while he proves to us that he is capable of making tough decisions.
He's not ready for this, Ethan says.
Deltok turns to me with a smile that says, I told you so.
I am too, I shout. You don't know what you're... Do not talk to him as if you have any idea what he is or what he is capable of,
Deltok says. Then he adds a single damning word.
Human.
And for the first time since meeting Deltok, I'm on his side. Ethan is my friend, but he's never been in my position before. He's the one who tells me I need rest when I know I can keep training and can push myself harder. The one who tells me to act like I'm on top of the food chain and then tries to tell me what to do. Ethan looks at me, breathless.
Do you really want your first kill to be this worthless girl?
when it could be 9?
I shift my eyes back to Emma, who has tears running down her face. She's staring at me, waiting for my decision. I can see the pleading in her eyes. And even though I don't want to, all I can think of are the good times we had back in Miami. I know that she's not the only one holding her breath, that Deltok and Ethan and the Moogs all around are watching to see how I act. And I suddenly feel like there's so much pressure in my brain that it might explode, because I don't know what I'm supposed to do. I can't disappoint the Moogs. I can't show weakness. Deltok obviously brought me out here to kill this girl. Unless there's some other way. Is your brother still a wannabe gangster in Miami? I ask Emma. She looks confused. Answer me! I shout, more out of frustration with the situation than with her silence.
Yes,
she says. The rest of us left after what happened, but he stayed. Both of us descend to the ground. When her feet touch, I release her from my telekinetic grip. She crumples to the earth. I turn my back on her and walk to Deltok and Ethan. Her brother might be of use to us, I say to them. He was small time when I was in Miami, but he may have gained some kind of influence, connections we can exploit. We should use her to leverage any information out of him that might be valuable in tracking the guard, the same way we're using FBI resources. Maybe nothing will come of it, but she's definitely no good to us if she's dead.
5, Ethan starts.
I've been reading book after book on how wars are fought. Information can be just as powerful as armies. You should take her to the detention wing, Ethan. After all, she knows you. You're part of the reason she's here. Ethan doesn't say anything, but I can tell he's clenching his jaw. He's not used to me talking to him like this. But I can't help it. My adrenaline is pumping out of control, taking charge. I feel like a leader. If you need to know what happened before you got out here for your reports, I say, lingering on the last word, I'll be happy to fill you in. Ethan stares at me for a few seconds, as if he's trying to figure out where all this is coming from. Then he throws a spite-filled glance at Deltok and grabs Emma's arm, dragging her into the woods. She doesn't put up much of a fight.
A wise decision, Deltok says.
Was this some sort of test? I ask.
All of life is a test. You of all people should know that.
Did I pass? I ask. Deltok's lips spread wide.
With flying colors.
Chapter 5. A few weeks go by, and then everything happens very quickly. The Moogs track one of the guard to a place called Paradise, Ohio, but 2 end up being there. At least, that's what survivors of the battle say. Not that many Moogs are left standing after they tried to apprehend the 2 Lorik fighters. From what the commanders can gather, one of them was number 6. Who used to be in Moog captivity, but managed to escape before I was brought on board. Practically all of our forces are reassigned to track the 2 across the country, leaving less pressing matters like my history lessons ignored. Something impossible also happens. I get hurt. 4 is still alive. I know that because there's no new scar on my ankle. But when one of the Moog soldiers I'm sparring with hits my arm with a sword, I get cut. Blood actually runs out of my shoulder, and the soldier is left completely unharmed. The Lorik charm has been broken. I am vulnerable. It's a weird thing to suddenly be able to die, or get hurt, to know that there's not another number standing in the way of me and nothingness. It's kind of terrifying at first, but it just reminds me that I've made the right decision. I can't imagine facing the Moog armies without a charm protecting me. The guard don't stand a chance if they can't be convinced of their idiocy. Ethan freaks out about my sudden mortality and demands that Deltok stop any training that involves actual fighting. He says I'm not ready for field work yet. Of course he does. but Deltok agrees enough to put my fight training on hold. Instead, I make myself useful by scouring the internet for anything that might be helpful. That's how I stumble on a website called Aliens Anonymous. And while it's full of a bunch of stuff that sounds like total bullshit, it also has articles about what went down in Paradise. The posts sound like they're written by someone who knows about the guard and the Moogs. Someone who might have an idea as to where Six and the other guard ran off to after the battle. So using a little bit of persuasion, I manage to get in tight with some of the editors and contributors on the blog. They know me as Flyboy. There's one idiot who goes by Jolly Roger 182, who claims to have been involved in the battle in Ohio. He's hesitant to talk about it at first, but when I feed him a made-up story about seeing some guys with black eyes and head tattoos chasing after some sad-looking teenager who ended up flying through the air, he starts to ask me a ton of questions. Questions I'll only answer once he tells me what he knows. So he spills. He says his former classmate was one of the guard, a guy named John Smith. But more important, the backwoods asshat tells me something else. John is number 4. When I give this news to Ethan, he says he's sure the Moogs already have someone watching the blog, and that I probably shouldn't get in too deep with the editors there, in case I accidentally let something slip. I tell him that's ridiculous, and that he doesn't know what a good liar I am. And we get into an argument that ends with me going to Deltok myself and telling him about what I've discovered. I swear it's the first time I've ever seen the Moog look like he's happy with me. He tells me to keep doing what I'm doing, that Satrakis Ra is pleased with me. After that, I start to see more and more of the Moogs and less of Ethan. I think maybe he's jealous of me, even though I'm really just behaving the way he always said I should act. Like I'm a big shot here. Mostly I see him only when he briefs me on how things are going in the Moog's search for the guard or at meals. Deltok takes over my training. We track 4 and 6 across the country, from Ohio to Tennessee and then to Florida. Somehow they always stay a step ahead of our forces or end up taking out our scouts. But our big break comes when 4 makes a stupid move. He returns to Paradise, where the Moogs are obviously still sniffing around. And now, he's in our custody. I was kind of hoping 4 would be someone I could talk sense into easily, but based on what the Moogs and Jolly Roger 182 tells me, it sounds like he's a total idiot. I mean, you kind of have to be if you go back to the place the Moogs found you to begin with. I'm surprised his mark wasn't burned into my ankle months ago. He might still listen to reason. If so, maybe Satrakis Ra can give him Europe to rule, or Africa or something. But there's one person who definitely won't be getting his own continent. Things are moving fast here in the compound, including my promotion to commander over the Moog forces. The Loric charm is broken. I don't have to worry about some strange magic hurting me if I try to harm another guard. 9's time is up. And our beloved leader, Satrakis Ra, is coming to personally oversee me execute him. The thought of finally taking my rightful place as a leader within the Moog forces blacks out practically all hesitation I have about 9. When the time comes, I'll just have to remind myself of the files the Moogs had on him and power through it. I can bleed now. That means 9 can bleed too. My time has come. The morning of my ascension, I'm called into one of the Moog science labs. There's apparently been some sort of big discovery they want my help with, and while I'm flattered, I already have a lot on my mind thanks to what's going to happen that night when 9 is dragged into the Great Hall in chains and I take my spot as a commander of the Moog forces. It doesn't help that they keep me waiting in the lab. As time ticks by, I grow bored and find a notepad and pen. I start to draw. I haven't had a chance to draw stories or anything like I used to in the sand on the beaches since I've been at the Moog base. But now, in the labs, I remember how much I used to like to do this. I draw a 9. He's held to the ground by heavy chains attached to a collar around his neck. He's frail and weak. I, on the other hand, look like a superhero. I float above him, Nine is so insignificant that I don't even dirty my hands with him. Instead, I have a monster, an attack dog of sorts, that's going to dispatch him. The beast is like nothing that's ever walked on any planet. Probably. It's got three lizard-like heads and a furry body, with razor-sharp talons. And wings. It's the most badass hell beast I can imagine. All of its mouths are wide, and poisoned saliva drips from pointy teeth. Its gnarled arms...
Five,
someone says from behind me. I turn around. I've gotten so caught up in my drawing that I didn't even notice one of the Moog scientists come in. He wears a long black lab coat and white rubber gloves. In his hands is something I recognize. I almost leap off my stool because I think for a second that someone's been in my room and taken my Lorik chest. But then I realize it's not mine. The gleaming symbol on it doesn't belong to me.
"We recovered this chest from one of the Lorik in Ohio," the scientist says, gently placing it on a workbench. "We thought maybe you might want to try to open it."
"What makes you think I can?" I ask. The scientist shrugs.
"We believe this chest belongs to Number Four. We're hoping that higher-ranking numbers might have unbridled access to the chests of those beneath them."
I think of Nine's file and the mentality that he is the most powerful among us because of his number and clench my fists. I know I haven't been great about figuring out how to use things in my own chest, but the thought of him being able to rifle through my stuff makes my pulse pound. "All right," I say. "Let me try." I do everything I can think of. The chest doesn't react to my touch. I pry at it with my telekinesis until I have a splitting headache. Finally, I use my externa to turn to metal and start banging on the side of the damned thing. The scientist is not thrilled about this last bit.
"If you would, sir,"
he says, trying very politely to step between my super-strong metal body and the chest.
"Maybe we should call it a day. We'll keep the chest under close watch until after the ceremony tonight. And then you can give it another try later."
I allow my body to revert back to normal. "Sure," I say. "Is that all?" The scientist nods. I'm almost out of the lab when he speaks again.
"Sir, you forgot your drawing."
I turn back. He's holding up my doodle, my one-page story. I suddenly feel stupid for having drawn it. "Keep it," I say. "After today, I will have no more need for childish things." He stares at the notebook.
"Perhaps this can be of some inspiration in my work."
I shrug and then leave. Ethan meets me in the hallway outside. I'm a little surprised to see him and wonder how long he's been waiting outside.
"What's up?"
"Just trying to help out the scientists a little," I say. "What are you doing here?" I ask. He pushes a carefully folded stack of black clothes into my hands.
"I wanted to be the one to give you this," he says.
"What is it?" I ask.
"Your ceremonial uniform," he says. "What you'll wear tonight when you ascend to your new position."
He nods at my jeans and t-shirt.
"From now on, you should start wearing a Mogadorian officer's uniform. It'll remind everyone who sees you of your position."
"There won't be any need for that," I say. "After tonight, everyone will know me as their superior regardless of what I wear." Ethan smirks a little and nods. But there's a sadness in his expression I can't place. Maybe it's just because he doesn't have his usual painted-on grin.
"I want to apologize for the whole thing with Emma," Ethan says slowly. "I know I should have done so earlier, but then everything got crazy. I never should have questioned whether or not you're ready for this. Obviously you are."
"Thanks," I say. He leans in close.
"They never should have brought her here," he whispers.
"Well, at least she's alive."
"Is that what they told you?"
he asks, his eyebrows knit together. Deltok said she was sent to another base somewhere closer to Florida, I say. My thoughts start to race. Ethan makes it sound like she's not actually in Florida. So where would she be? I shouldn't be concerned with Emma, but I am. And if the Moogs are lying to me about her, then... But Ethan smiles and reassures me.
I'm sure that's where she is, then, he says. I haven't heard anything myself.
We start the long walk back to my side of the compound, and even though I try to forget about Emma, thoughts of her keep nagging at the back of my mind. I wonder if I should ask Deltok about her. No, obviously I can't. That would show weakness. But I forget about Emma when we enter the cavernous main hall and I see figures like I've never seen on the base before. Moog women, dressed in long gowns and deep purples and reds. Their heads and faces are heavily tattooed. Most of them have gleaming black braids or ponytails jutting out of their shaved heads. Unlike the soldiers I'm used to seeing, they're thinner and more snake-like in their movements, long arms rippling at their sides as they walk. There are others who I've never seen before, too. Only a few of them. Young-looking Moogs about my age, if I had to guess. They're dressed in expensive-looking uniforms that aren't unlike those that the Moog commanders wear.
True-born Mogadorian children, Ethan says, noticing where my eyes are. And several women from high-ranking families. They've come to see you take your place among the officers.
I smile ear to ear. I can't help it. It feels so incredible to have all of these people here for me, to cheer me on. I realize that Five is kind of a weird name for the newest Moog leader. It's just so... Loric. I wonder if I should go back to one of the other names I used in the past. Bolt. Maybe Cody? I know Cody doesn't sound very Mogadorian, but I was him for a long time. That's who I was when Ethan first met me. As we round the corner to the hallway my study is on, a question comes to my mind that I've never thought to ask before. How did you know I was number Five? I ask.
What do you mean?
Ethan's eyebrows scrunch together. When I found you in your study talking to Commander Deltok, before I knew what was going on, you both referred to me as number Five. But how did you know that's who I was? There were only two dead, and the Moogs had only captured Six and Nine before. Ethan looks at me as if this is the strangest question I could possibly ask.
When you first got to the beach house, you used to draw in the sand all of the time, he says in his calm, smooth voice. Pictures and stories and strange symbols. The tide always washed them away, but I got to see some of them from the house.
Of course. He was probably always keeping an eye on me.
The only symbol I could ever make out was the numeral Five.
I feel stupid. How easily I gave myself away. I'd gotten into the habit of drawing in the sand back on the island with Ray, but I'd always watched as the water destroyed anything I created. I thought I'd been so careful. So clever. So they didn't know what number I was when they first recruited me. I must look unhappy because he places a hand on my shoulder.
Is everything okay, Five?
I shrug. I guess I'm just wondering if the Moogs were bummed I was a low-ranking number and not, like, number 8.
Ethan's face scrunches up. Five. We wanted you for you, regardless of what number you were. I saw your potential the moment we first met on the beach. I could see the hunger for this in your eyes.
I smile a little. Thanks, Ethan.
Is this about 9? Are you worried that you're not ready to take the next step?
A couple of Moog soldiers run by us. There must be a fire somewhere that needs to be put out. Some prisoner who needs to be taught a lesson or a high-ranking commander who needs an entourage. Of course I'm ready, I say.
Five, listen to me. You have to do this. You have to do whatever it is the Moogs ask of you, as long as it means you'll ascend to the highest levels of their ranks on Earth. You're not just doing this for yourself, you know.
I'm counting on you to let me live in the beach house again once you're running the planet.
You should follow your own rules, I say with a smirk. The way you argued with Deltok
was stupid.
He grins that grin, ear to ear. Let's go then, I say. I'm ready to do this. More Moogs run by, and then suddenly the hallways are teeming with soldiers. Some of them are yelling, but I can't make out what they're saying. The noise echoing off the stone walls and floor turns everything into a roar of sound.
What the hell is going on? Ethan shouts.
And then there's an explosion somewhere inside the base, and everything goes insane.